exposes corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius Satellite Radio, on RadioPower.org and WhiteRoseSociety.org, and on CRN Digital on cable systems in 29 states. Welcome to our program. So glad to have you back with us. It is Friday, and as always on Fridays, the first hour of our program, we have Congressman Bernie Sanders on Brunch with Bernie, our regular Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Sanders, the only independent member, neither a Democrat nor a Republican, the only independent member of the House of Representatives. He has been reelected 7 times, the longest serving independent in the history of the House of Representatives. And I think of Bernie as America's congressman. He represents the interests of so many of us beyond just his constituency in Vermont, although he does a brilliant job of representing his constituents in Vermont as well. And Bernie's websites, bernie.house.gov, his main website, and bernie.org as well. And our telephone number, if you'd like to call and talk with Bernie Sanders today, 1-866-889-8894, toll-free across the United States. From outside the United States, area code 503-248-0620. Bernie Sanders, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you here, Bernie. Bernie, as we were just wrapping up the show last week, one of our callers made a comment and essentially said that he was agreeing with a position that I had taken or something like that, and I just wanted to make the point that I'll speak for myself. And I don't know if you recall that, and if you do, then I wanted to clear that up, and if you don't, then it's no big deal. But I've been thinking about it all week, so I had to get that out. Yeah, you know, sometimes things just kind of, you know, stick. Anyhow, so what's on your mind today?
I'll tell you what's on my mind, Tom. You know, you and I very often talk about the media in America and our frustration that more and more media is controlled by larger and larger corporate conglomerates. That the American people are not really hearing some of the most important issues which really impact their lives. That we hear a whole lot about Michael Jackson, that public officials have 6 seconds in order to talk about important issues, that we're constantly worried about all kinds of things about except what's really going on in the lives of ordinary Americans. And in thinking about this, I just picked up an article the other day, which I want to talk about for a half a second here. And that is, I wonder, when we talk about the economy, how many people know how the CEOs of the Forbes 500 did last year in their compensation? So it's one of the issues in our economy is the middle class is shrinking.
Let's explain the Forbes 500 for those people who don't know.
Forbes 500 is the Forbes magazine index of the 500 largest corporations in America. They are the powerhouse of the American economy. They are the largest corporations. And Forbes every year does an annual report, primarily for the business community, as a matter of fact, to talk about CEO compensation. While the average American is working longer hours for lower wages, while poverty is increasing, do you know what the CEOs on average of the Forbes 500 saw as an increase in their compensation last year?
I'll let you tell the folks.
The answer is 54%.
Yeah, my Rick.
Now,
yeah.
What is astounding about that is not only the fact this is going to continue to lead in the direction of a growing gap between the rich and the poor, a growing gap between employer and worker, a more and more unequal distribution of wealth and income. That's an extremely important factor. But you know what else? Nobody knows about it. You would think that this would be a story written up all over the media. Turns out that there is a woman that I've known for many years, Holly Sklar. Holly writes about economic issues. She's in Boston. She has a website of her own. Mm-hmm. And she said she read this in the Forbes magazine. Well, I checked it out, and there it is. It was true. 54% increase for the major CEOs in America, while the average worker is seeing a decline in his and her wages compared to inflation. Growing gap between the rich and the poor. Don't you think when we talk about the economy that this is an issue that the media might want to focus just a little bit on?
And isn't it particularly ironic, Bernie Sanders, that Alan Greenspan sees and has said publicly that one of his jobs is to prevent what he calls wage inflation? and that whenever wages are increasing too fast, then he's got to crank up interest rates to slow down the economy so that he can cool off wage inflation. But somehow CEO wage inflation is just fine with him.
Right, and here's what Forbes itself says. As a group, we're talking about 500 CEOs, their total compensation amounted to $5.1 billion in 2004, as opposed to $3.3 billion in 2003. That's a lot of money for a relatively small number of folks. But again, one of the issues about the economy that we have got to focus on is what are the most important factors? And clearly what the most important factor is, it's not just job growth and so forth. It's what's happening to the average person. And what's happening to the average worker in America today is, by and large, especially for young people, the new jobs that are being created are low-wage jobs, often with minimal benefits. Meanwhile, for the people on top, as this country moves more and more to an oligarchic form of government, people on top are making out like bandits. CEOs doing extraordinarily well. And on top of that, of course, you have the president and a Republican Congress rewarding these guys with huge tax breaks, rewarding these corporations with trade agreements that make it easier for them to ship good-paying jobs to China, Nicaragua, or elsewhere. And I think those are some of the economic issues that this country has got to focus on.
Yeah, moving toward an oligarchy. Describe in your mind what an oligarchy means and you know, how it might be in conflict with democracy.
You know, when we think about democracy, and you know, Tom, as you well know, because you're an historian and you're a writer, democracy is a pretty radical idea. And it's, you know, a fairly new concept. And what it says is that ordinary people, regular people, have a right to control the destiny of their country. Pretty radical idea. It used to be kings and queens who had the divine right of God to make all of the decisions. They decided tax policy, what people pay. They decided when their country went to war. And for a thousand different reasons, from a historical perspective, we evolved into what many of us want to see as a democracy. And what's happening now in America is you are seeing the power increasingly going to the hands of very, very wealthy people. Now, how does that manifest itself? Well, obviously, from an economic perspective, you have fewer and fewer large multinational corporations controlling our economy, and they make decisions as to whether jobs they invest in the United States create decent-paying jobs here or they move abroad. They make the decision as to how they relate to trade unions. Are they going to work with workers who are trying to organize and bargain collectively, or do you destroy unions? They make the decision as to whether or not we're going to have workers will have decent benefits or not. And what we're seeing in America is the loss, as you know, of pensions for many large corporations have given up the traditional pensions, moved to other forms of pensions, slash pensions. They make those decisions. Politically, what is happening, of course, is that the people who have the money increasingly are investing in campaign contributions, in lobbying, so that you have industries like the pharmaceutical industry, which have some 700 or 800 paid lobbyists in Washington, D.C., putting enormous influence on members of Congress and on the White House, resulting in Americans paying the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs. You see the credit card companies and the banks exerting enormous influence, resulting in people in the United States paying 25% or 30% in interest rates. You're seeing, you know, the trade policy being influenced by these corporate interests. So politically, we have a situation where, to a very significant degree, Congress reflects the interests of the wealthy and the powerful. Economically, these guys have more and more power at the expense of workers. In terms of media, how do you create a culture in America which protects the interests of the wealthy and the powerful? Well, among other things, you don't talk about issues like the fact that the gap between the rich and the poor is growing wider. Is it moral? Is it right for the CEOs of large corporations to earn 300, 400, 500 times what their workers make? Is that moral? Is that right? Is it right that companies like Walmart are putting pressure on suppliers to literally move abroad in order to provide them with the products that they sell in their store? Is it moral for banks and credit card companies to charge people 25% or 30%. Those issues we very rarely discuss because the media is much more interested in sensationalism, in political gossip, in crime, in accidents. in scandal rather than trying to educate the American people about the foundations of what's going on in our country and, in fact, how we can move toward a more democratic society and a society based on social justice and environmental sanity. So that's what oligarchy, to my mind, is about. It's big money exerting their influence over the economy at the expense of working people. It's big money influencing very heavily the political process. You know, in the United States Senate now, my understanding is that about 60% of the members of the Senate are themselves millionaires, very, very wealthy people. And many of the others are influenced by big money interests. Really, that's the political thing. And media-wise, it is becoming very difficult because we're seeing through mergers and takeovers, fewer and fewer large conglomerates.
So how do we if oligarchy is rule by the wealthy few and democracy is ruled by we the people, how do we move from oligarchy back to democracy?
Well, first of all, back to democracy. I mean, it's not like we've ever had, you know, I think we're losing ground, but we don't want to overstate what used to be the case.
Sure.
We don't want to say, gee, 30, 40 years ago, the media was just fantastic and too bad it's bad. No, it's never been all that good. It's worse now. I think, as I've said many times on this show, Tom, we need a political revolution in this country in the sense that ordinary people understand. That's something the media does not really convey to them. Lobbyists know it. The corporations know it. They're all over Washington. Trust me. They're there through billions of dollars of lobbying efforts and so forth and so on. But ordinary people have got to understand that what takes place in their state capital, what takes place in Washington, D.C., has enormous impact on their lives, not just Iraq, not just the issue of the Patriot Act and civil liberties, but whether or not our kids are going to have a lower standard of living than we do for the first time in modern American history because of the loss of good-paying jobs. There are reasons for this. God didn't create this. These are political decisions made by people who have special interests. Somebody says it's much more important for General Electric, IBM, other large corporations to make huge profits than to make sure that our kids have decent-paying jobs. Those are decisions made by human beings sitting in boardrooms. And the answer to that, the antidote to that, is not going to happen overnight. And we're seeing some good things happening, by the way. And that is strong grassroots political activism, certainly in the last couple of years through the Internet, through groups like True Majority, MoveOn.org, and other groups, through more progressive media like your radio show and Air America and other good shows. We are seeing, I think, a revitalization of progressive-type politics, where ordinary people are saying, wait a second, you know what? The government of the United States is my government and not just multinational corporations.
Yeah, well said. Congressman Bernie Sanders is with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment every Friday, first hour of our program here. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. Our telephone number, if you would like to speak with Congressman Sanders, 1-866-889-8894. If you want to drop into our live chat room, go to tomhartman.com and click live chat up at the top of the page. It'll drop you in there. We'll be right back with more Bernie Sanders and your phone calls after this, 20 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Mama, don't let your babies grow up to be cowboys.
Or if you do, don't let them go near Crawford, Texas. Welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here. It's Brunch with Bernie. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. Jeff in Atlanta, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Hey, guys. I got off the phone with Neil Bortz a little while ago, and I was pressing him to explain why Saddam was an imminent threat. And he went through a list of United Nations sanctions and this, that, and the other thing. And I know you guys are going to tell me something completely different. And I've read enough to know you guys are the right guys, right on the issue. But we need to have a better understanding of why it is and what it is that people like Bortz, like, why is that big disconnect between our facts and their facts, and how can we confront them with what are apparently the real facts?
Bernie?
Well, that's a very good question. I think one of the real concerns that many of us have is that different segments of American society are living in different worlds, getting their information from different sources, and are totally convinced that the information they get is 100% accurate. All I could tell you is, as a member of Congress, is that we were told in private, top secret meetings, that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, and that they could be used against the United States, and that it was therefore a logical response to that to wage a preemptive type war. The response that a number of us made to that is, the United Nations is all over Iraq now. Give them the time, give them the opportunity to find those weapons of mass destruction before you develop a new policy for the United States of preemptive war, which we have never used before, which opens up the gateway for every country on earth to go to war for any reason they want at any time that they want. And history has indicated that, in fact, he did not have weapons of mass destruction. History, Downing Street memo, and other information seems to suggest that Bush had wanted to go to war very early on in the process, and that he, quote-unquote, according to the Downing Street memo, fixed the intelligence to conform to what he wanted to do. I think a lot of this has to do with politics. If you are a supporter of the president, your mind moves to justifying what the president does, taking what he says and accepting that as the truth. But what I will say in conclusion on that is that I think more and more people understand that the president, in fact, did fix the intelligence, had decided to go to war, regardless of what the objective evidence was.
Thank you, Bernie. Rick in Grand Rapids on the line. Hey, Rick, you're live with Congressman Sanders.
Yes, good day, gentlemen. Bernie, I wanted to ask you your opinion of this lady, Cindy Sheehan, the mother of one of the soldiers that died recently.
Yes.
On the Crawford there. And I think it's already started, but you think pretty soon there'll be a full-blown demonization of her by the right wing. They'll find out maybe that she's a communist or her parents were communists or what have you. I mean, it just seems to me that anybody, whether it's Scott Ritter or Joe Wilson or anybody, that just questions the justification of this war is just not only immediately called wrong for not believing in the war, but they're just completely demonized as human beings.
The politics of personal destruction.
Well, that is Karl Rove's modus operandi. That's what they do. They don't deal with the facts being raised. They just go and try to destroy the people. So I don't know what's going to happen to her, but I think certainly parents of people who have been killed in the war have a right to sit down with the president and to discuss the issue with them. But I think it's not, to be honest with you, and, you know, the media has picked up on the fact that she is the mother of a soldier who died. The president has a right to honestly debate and discuss this issue with the American people. What we take for granted in America is a president running around to Social Security meetings where people who disagree with him are not allowed to ask questions. Probably the only time in a four-year period you really see the president in a position of having to answer questions that he's not comfortable with is a presidential debate. That's a pretty pathetic type situation. So it's not only having to address the grieving parents of men and women who were killed in Iraq, it is the American people. It is, and our demand should be, Mr. President, let's have an honest debate on this issue.
Yeah, and many others that he's advancing as well.
That's right, not just Iraq.
There you go. We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment every Friday afternoon. On the first hour of our program, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. We'll be back with your calls after this. It's Tom Hartman, 29 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 27 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman with you. It's Congressman Bernie Sanders with us, our Brunch with Bernie segment every Friday afternoon. Don in South Carolina, you're live with Congressman Sanders, Don.
Yes, good afternoon, gentlemen. I investigate different websites as to what's going on, and I commend organizations like yours and several others. And one thing I'd like to ask, do you know anything about a federal prosecutor by the name of Jack Fitzgerald who allegedly has indicted President Bush, Vice President Cheney, and his members of his cabinet?
You mean Patrick Fitzgerald?
Patrick, excuse me, I'm sorry.
Bernie?
Nope.
Okay. Sorry about that, Don.
Sure,
there we go. Well, we'll see how that plays out. Will in Pittsburgh on the line. Hey, Will, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Tom, and good morning, Congressman.
Good morning, Bill.
Sir, it's a pleasure to listen to you every Friday, I'm sorry.
Thank you very much.
No, believe you me, Mr. Sanders. I've been a registered independent when I came home from the Army in 1968, and I know what you have to go through. I wanted to ask you about the Seven Sisters, the oil companies.
Yep.
Am I saying that properly?
Yep.
Do you know Mr. David Walker? He is the head of the G.
Right, of course. GAO, yeah.
And I don't know if I mentioned this to Tom, but Vice President Cheney absolutely refused to turn over records from the his energy bill or
right.
where this money
is. The meetings that he had with these guys behind closed doors.
Would you please, and I will hang up. I know you're going to get a lot of calls. Tom, thanks again, always. But would you please elaborate on that for me?
Sure.
And why do we not have a man of David Walker's ethics and rigid honesty in every state? Thank you, sir.
Okay.
Thank you, Will.
Thank you, Will. The issue here is that early on in the Bush administration, if my memory is correct, Cheney met with a lot of the CEOs of major corporations, getting their input and ideas as to what would constitute an energy bill that I presume would work for them. And there has been a demand over the years to try to get information about those meetings, who was there, and so forth and so on, without, to the best of my knowledge, success. Probably the result of those meetings is what we saw a few weeks ago in the energy bill that finally passed, which to my mind was an absolute disaster. At a time when oil companies are enjoying record-breaking profits, huge profits, where people are paying the highest prices that they have ever paid at the gas pump, at a time when home heating oil is going to be off the wall this winter, what the energy bill that was just passed, pushed by the Republican leadership, did is nothing to lower the cost of energy in the immediate future, but in fact provided about $10 billion in corporate welfare to oil companies, coal companies, and nuclear power companies. So I think it's pretty clear, to my mind at least, that those meetings brought the energy people together to tell the president and the vice president what they wanted in the bill, and in fact, that is pretty much what happened.
Thank you, Bernie. Well said. Our number 1-866-889-8894. Scott in San Diego, California, on the line. Scott, welcome to the program.
Good morning, gentlemen. Bernie, as always, it's definitely a pleasure talking with you. I have a question for you about a messaging from the Democrats. I know you being a progressive, you can't necessarily speak to the Democrat or you're an independent. You can't speak to these issues. But the thing is, it turns out is liberal talk radio is making a difference. It is helping to get the word out. And yet it seems to me, Bernie, that the Dems, you know, just aren't using it. I don't hear Barbara Boxer on the radio. Well, she's my senator. I don't hear as much of the Democrats on liberal talk radio as I hear Republicans on conservative talk radio.
Mm-hmm.
Should the Democrats adopt, get a more national platform, a message out, start using the liberal talk radio more?
Yeah, I think that's a
Bernie style. Well, you know, Bernie style is that you have an issue, you stick to it, you drive the issue, you're very personal in your district. What do you think would be effective for the Dems nationally?
Well, Scott, I think you raise a very good issue, and I think actually that is exactly something that Howard Dean is trying to implement. Having said that, the good news is that we have come quite a distance in the last few years on talk radio. 4 years ago, if you listen to talk radio, all you would hear is the Rush Limbaughs and real right-wing extremists on the radio. And increasingly, we had a long, long way to go, but we're hearing voices like Tom Hartman, and we're hearing Air America, and we're hearing Ed Schultz, and we're hearing some good people out there. Your thought about getting members of Congress on a regular basis or irregular basis on the radio to update listeners about what the major issues are that Congress are dealing with is, I think, an excellent idea, and it's something that should be pursued.
It seems to me, Bernie, too, that the Democratic Party has been very timid in actually taking on the agenda of this administration, whether it's the war or whether it's the economy. You know, it's almost like they're afraid to speak up for fear they'll be slapped down. It seems to me like the abused wife syndrome or the abused spouse syndrome.
Well, that's another issue. I mean, it's above and beyond what Scott was talking about, and that is, you know, the Democratic Party and the strengths and weaknesses of the Democratic Party. When I was elected in 19 and took office in 91, I formed the Progressive Caucus, which consists of about 53 Democrats and myself, which is a caucus that speaks out very strongly on Iraq, on the economy, on the need for a national health care program, on the environment, and so forth. We are a minority, you know, within the Democratic caucus. You have some pretty conservative Democrats. I would agree with you, Tom, that I think, you know, it's my own view, that if the Democratic Party is to make significant headway, they have got to focus on those issues, primarily economic issues, which reflect the needs of the vast majority of the people. I think for a lot of folks out there, a lot of working-class people, middle-class people, they're saying, well, you know, I may be pro-choice, anti-choice, or this or that, pro-war, anti-war, but you know what? Which political party is speaking to the fact that I'm working longer hours for lower wages, that I lost my job, that my pension is gone, that I don't have any health insurance, and that I can't afford to send my kids to college? Who's talking about those issues? Who is prepared to take on the big money interest? You know, you do these polls, people know who has the power in America, and yet you hear very little discussion in Congress about pointing their finger at large multinational corporations who have so much influence. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, the obscenity of the CEOs of large corporations seeing a 54% increase in their compensation packages while the average worker is falling further and further behind. How many people are talking about that issue?
Yeah, it's not, certainly not enough. Let's go back to the phones. Mike in St. Louis, Missouri on the line. You're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders. Our number, by the way, 1-866-889-8894. Mike, what's up?
Good morning, Bernie.
Good morning.
My question involves the lobbyist. How do we do something about it? This has been going on for decades, and the undue influence of those people, the big money, continues and seems like it's going to continue forever. And another question I had was, can we not start moving to direct democracy like Switzerland, for example, since we now have better interactive communications technology?
Well, you raise two good questions. The first, in terms of the power. The power of the lobbyists is simply an extension of the power of money. The pharmaceutical industry, for example, just as one case in point, has spent hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. A lot of that money goes to lobbying. They hire Democratic leaders, Republican leaders, who then converge on Capitol Hill to see their old pals and get them to do what the pharmaceutical industry wants them to do. I think clearly what you want to do, among many other things, is strengthen some of the laws that exist right now, which keep former elected officials away from Capitol Hill, and there is some discussion about that going on. But I think really that issue takes us to the issue of more significantly, is the issue of campaign finance reform and undoing a situation where big money continues to buy elections. And that means moving toward publicly funded elections, which limit the amount of money that can be spent on an election. When I talked about it earlier, Tom, about moving toward an oligarchy, one of the problems that we're seeing is in state after state, zillions of dollars being spent on elections. Independently wealthy people who work for a lot of money, they say, hey, I want to be a governor, I want to be this, and they just write out a check for themselves, or money interest will support somebody.
Right. In fact, I understand in Vermont that there's talk that the Republican who may challenge you in the next election is talking about pulling $5 million bucks out of his own back pocket.
That's one case out of many. It's going on. Yeah, it's going on all over the country. So I think what you need to do is we need to focus, as we try to move toward a real democracy, is limiting the power of big money. And I think, among other things, that means public financing of elections.
Yeah, it seems to be working well in Maine and Arizona, where it's,
right,
you know,
it does.
Two
That's
test
right.
tubes for democracy there. Harry in Eureka, Arkansas is on the line. Hey, Harry, welcome to the program.
Oh, it's a breath of fresh air to hear the congressman say what he says. I just want to know when somebody's going to step up and just lay out the issues, lay out a plan that everybody understands. The American public is smart. There's so much information out there. Lay out just a common-sense plan and get us out of this mess and be a leader, and they'll be elected. I'm an outside salesman. I see talk to people all day long. All they hear is the Democrats hate the Republicans, Republicans hate Democrats, and nothing gets done. So if anybody would step up to the plate, lay out a plan for health care, lay out a plan for our deficit, lay out our plan for immigration, and go into the details, people would vote for.
We need a new deal, Bernie.
Harry raises two good, and that is, number one, I think he's saying we need an agenda and a program that makes sense to ordinary people, and we need people to carry that agenda. The problem in terms of carrying the agenda, Harry, is you would be surprised to know this, but there are some of us who do talk about these issues. Unfortunately, they're not going to be on the front pages of newspapers all over the country. Very often, the more significant the issue, the less coverage it gets. The more trivial, superficial the issue, the more coverage it gets. So if there was, you know, if there was, there are. There are people there who are prepared to talk about important issues. Unfortunately, you may not hear about it, Harry, because they ain't going to make CBS or NBC or CNN. And if they do, they'll be on for 4 seconds giving a soundbite. And that's, you know, gets back to the whole issue of the media. But the other point that Harry makes, the need for a solid, consistent, progressive agenda that speaks to the needs of the middle class and working families rather than the wealthy and the powerful, the need to do away with bickering. What the media likes, it's not just the people do it, and they do. Democrats attack Republicans, Republicans attack Democrats. That does happen. But the media prefers that, frankly. I mean, I mentioned a moment ago, again, this obscenity, 54% increase in CEO compensation. What does that mean? Why is that not talked about?
Yeah, at the same time, they're saying, oh, we can't afford to pay the flight attendants. We can't afford to pay the pilots. We can't afford to pay the mechanics.
Yeah, that's right.
And but one the CEO of these, sure can take a salary.
That's right. But what the media likes is this conflict. You know, Howard Dean says something, my God, it's all over the place attacking somebody. Republicans say something, it's all over the place. But if somebody comes up with a thoughtful discussion, you know, about where this country might go in a way that benefits the middle class, you might see it on C-SPAN. You might hear it on some talk radio shows, but by and large, it is not going to get a whole lot of media coverage.
Yeah. Dennis in Kentucky is on the line. Dennis, welcome to the program. You're live with Congressman Sanders.
Hello, Congressman Sanders and Tom. Love you
both.
Hey,
Terrence.
I guess everybody is sort of a groundswell. Everybody's sort of pointing to the same thing, and we're saying it in different ways. And my idea, too, is, and you feel free to use it, mandate to save America. Do something similar to what Newt Gingrich did.
Mm-hmm.
We have to turn
mm-hmm.
around and use their effective weapons against them that was effective against us. And that was the most effective weapon, a contract with America. And I suggest maybe the title, Mandate to Save America, starting with putting the American citizens first. And, you know, that'd be the first rung on the ladder, I guess, that we would want to go with, and many more there. But everybody seems to, that just called in the last few minutes, seems to be pointing to the same thing. What
That's
can
right.
we do to get everybody's attention? And we have to simplify it and put a message that everybody can understand, a summarization of a business plan. And basically, we have to just say, mandate to save America, and, you know, just put down five or six things that we're going to take care of. And anybody that's on board with that, I think you can get the Black Congressional Congress or caucus to go with you, most of it. And, you know, that's 40 people right there, I think, that will sign
mm-hmm.
on with you
mm-hmm.
right away. I've heard a lot of them from Harold Ford to Conyers. They all seem to want to put America first again, too. So, I mean, that's an idea there that maybe – you, being an independent, can take the lead in that.
Well, thank you. Terrence, I think you've raised a very good issue. I think your point about making it straightforward and simple, you're absolutely right. The Newt Gingrich's 1994 contract with America was a brilliant political stroke, and I think we need to do something like that. I mean, even your title about mandate to save America, it's a funny thing. If you ask the president, he would say, we're doing well. What's the problem? What are you even talking about? So the first thing we have to do is acknowledge the very serious problems facing our country, and I think most Americans understand that. The economy is not doing well for the middle class. The care system is disintegrating. Your point, Terrence, about protecting the needs of American workers, as opposed to politicians who are busy worrying about the growth of the Chinese economy, maybe we should worry about creating decent jobs in the United States. So I think Terrence, Tom, makes a very good point.
Yep. Joe in Provo, Utah, we have about a minute left. Joe, you're live.
Hey, yes, I am. Congressman Tom, great show, and I love this segment. It's wonderful. You know, I would like your take on this, Congressman. It seems to me that one of the simple conversations we can put forward is there's systemic issues and specific issues, and until we deal with a major systemic issue to this country, we'll never be able to resolve the specific issues, and that is getting corporate and special interest money out of Washington, voting for corporate-free candidates, regardless of whether they're Republican, Democrat, Green. Let's get past the party stop and start looking at the candidates. Are they willing to be corporate-free? And if they are, then say to people, this is an advance democracy is an advanced citizenship. You can't stand by. You've got to participate, and this is where you need to go with it. What do you think?
Well, a very good point, Joe. The key problem in politics in America is the influence of big corporate money and wealthy individuals. And to the degree that we can free ourselves from that, we got to figure out how we create a democracy and a political system which is not beholden to big money interest. That is exactly what the issue is.
Yeah, well said. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders. It's the Tom Hartman radio program where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. We'll be back 10 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Sick and tired of feeling famous from outside, short-sighted, narrow-minded, hypocritics. I'm always the truth.
Yeah, you want some truth. Welcome back. Bernie Sanders, Congressman Bernie Sanders is with us, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Bernie, we have every single line is full, and we only have about 3 minutes, so let's move through this fairly quickly if we can ask folks to ask questions quickly. Bob in Indiana, you're on live with Congressman Sanders.
Yeah, I was wondering when Congress or somebody like Bernie is going to bring up and start addressing the oil depletion that we're facing. I mean, according to the latest Kunstler book, The Long Emergency, we're on Hubert's curve, too. We're going to reach our oil peak sometime later this year, Thanksgiving time, I think, is when they've done it. And the energy bill didn't address that. And I hear virtually nothing out of Washington about oil peaks.
Bernie?
But you're absolutely. And the answer is to absolutely move in a bold fashion to break our dependency on fossil fuel in general. The technology is out there now that we can move big time into sustainable energy. And one of the particular crimes of the recently passed energy bill is it virtually does nothing in that direction. Some very, very modest efforts, but nothing near where we need to go. So you're quite right. The time is now to break our dependency on oil and move to sustainable energy.
Paul in Little Rock, Arkansas. Hey, Paul.
Hey, greetings, guys. I've got a kind of a harebrained idea for how we can get Congress under control and make them address what the real issue is. I think we ought to choose by a lottery system one person from each state, and that group would oversee Congress and make them address issues of the people that they represent.
Okay, that's sort of actually how they did it in ancient Greece, but I don't think it's going to happen, Bernie.
Right. It's interesting concept, but I don't think it's going to happen.
George in Coos Bay, Oregon on the line. Hey, George.
Oh, hello.
We have about 30 seconds.
Yes, thank you. One thing that nobody seems to be mentioning is that Cheney and his group got everything that they wanted in their energy wish list, and including something that is completely off the charts, and that is the Iraq War. They divided up Iraq with a map, and this is all according to Judicial Watch.
Yeah, in March of 2001, yes, those documents were pried out with a lawsuit. Bernie, last 5 seconds here. You want to wrap up the show?
Well, it was a good show, and I think what people are demanding is that political leaders start focusing on the real issues facing ordinary people in a simple, straightforward manner, and that's exactly what we've got to do.
A simple, straightforward manner, and this isn't rocket science, after all.
Right.
I mean, it's like, what's the best thing for the people of America? Congressman Bernie Sanders, his website, house.bernie.gov or bernie.org. If you want to check it out, I encourage you to go visit Congressman Bernie Sanders. Thanks so much for being with us today, Bernie.
Good to be with you.
We'll see you next week.
Right.
It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 7 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman radio program, the real free speech zone. No passes from the RNC required. You won't be dragged off if you have a no blood for oil bumper sticker on your car. You can even call up and disagree. In fact, if you call up and disagree, we'll put you at the top of the list to get on the air. I like people who disagree with me. Not that I don't mind people who agree, but it's always nice to hear from both sides, to hear from the other side. And every now and then we can actually change somebody's mind. Anyhow, welcome back to our program. So glad to have you with us. Our toll-free number, 1-866-889-8894. The website, tomhartman.com. If you click on live chat, you can drop into our live chat room, which is well-populated with some of the finest minds in the entire Internet. And sometimes people think I'm saying that facetiously. And, you know, oh, he's just, you know, and then they go into the chat room and they hang out and they discover there's this place in the Internet where there's actually, like, intelligent conversation going on. I mean, you know, yeah, every now and then it gets a little strange. But by and large, the vast majority, really, really insightful, thoughtful, perceptive conversations going on in real time, in real space. And one of the things I find interesting about it is in most chat rooms, it seems like it's mostly men, you know, and it seems like a fairly even split between men and women these days in our chat room. So that's nice, too. Anyhow, welcome back to our program. Paula in Davenport, Iowa is on the line. Our telephone number, 866-889-8894. Hey, Paula, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you doing today?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Good. Well, just a couple of comments. I'm thinking in terms of the rush to war. If anyone were to go back and look at and put together a collage of all the speeches that George W., when he was trying his best to string more than two sentences together, would be able to determine that war was bogus, it was all a setup, how desperate he was for us to go to war, and anyone that was opposed to that war was considered unpatriotic. And the second thing that I want to express was that for anyone to think that poor woman who has lost her child, her son, the person she gave birth to, could endure any more pain than she's already gone through, rather not if the government wants to trash her or do whatever they think they can do to her to make her feel worse than she already feels. I don't think that will ever, ever happen. And as anyone that's a parent that has lost a child will be able to understand that.
Yeah,
that's all I have to say.
Thank you, Paul. I appreciate that. As Cindy Sheehan said on this program a couple of days ago, she said George Bush had no idea what he unleashed when he chose to go into this war and caused the death of my son. And in fact, you know, speaking of the speeches of George W. Bush, first of all, some of his historic war lies. Pretty amazing, actually, when you consider some of the things that he had to say on these topics.
As a condition for ending the Persian Gulf War,
right.
The Iraqi regime was required to destroy its weapons of mass destruction.
Which they did, by the way.
To cease all development of such weapons.
Which they did.
And to stop all support for terrorist groups.
And we know that they did that with the exception of the $25,000 they were sending to terrorist bombers, which is nothing compared to the money coming out of Saudi Arabia, even today.
The Iraqi regime has violated all of those obligations.
Bush knew that was a lie when he said it.
It possesses and produces chemical and biological weapons.
That's
it is
correct.
Seeking nuclear weapons.
And, you know, there it goes. And here's another one from Bush. It just keeps on keeping on, right? It's like, the you know, George W., the gift that keeps on giving him some of his old speeches.
If we know Saddam Hussein has dangerous weapons today,
I wish
and
you could
we
have
do,
a film clip of all that.
Does it make any sense for the world to wait to confront him as he grows even stronger and develops even more dangerous weapons?
This is incredible, Paula. Here's George W. Bush talking about what kind of weapons these guys have.
This is a massive stockpile of biological weapons and is capable of killing millions. We know that the regime has produced thousands of tons of chemical agents, including mustard gas, sarin nerve gas, VX nerve gas.
And then we find out, Paula, that Uday Hussein had a 14-foot balsa wood model airplane that was a toy of his. And they took a picture of that, and George Bush trotted this out and said, this is an unmanned aerial vehicle that they're going to use to attack the United States. Listen to this. This is incredible.
We've also discovered through intelligence that Iraq has a growing fleet of manned and unmanned aerial vehicles that could be used to disperse chemical or biological weapons across broad areas. We're concerned that Iraq is exploring ways of using these UAVs for missions targeting the United States.
So he's telling us right up front, they're going to come and get us, and maybe even with nukes.
Facing clear evidence of peril, we cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun, that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
So there are his lies in the beginning. And then yesterday he comes out and he changes the subject, because Cindy Sheehan says, Mr. President, I want to ask you, what is this noble cause you keep referring to that my son died for? And if it's so noble, why are your two unemployed daughters not volunteering to go to Iraq? And George W. tries to change the topic. He says that she's really saying that we should leave Iraq. No, really what she's saying is that he should level with us. Here's George Bush changing the topic yesterday.
Part of my duty as the president is to meet with those who've lost a loved one. And so, listen, I sympathize with Mrs. Sheehan.
Yeah, right.
She feels strongly about her position. She has every right in the world to say what she believes. This is America. She has a right to her position.
Oh, let's pat the little lady on the head, George.
And I thought long and hard about her position. I've heard her position from others, which is get out of Iraq now.
No, I'm sorry. Her position was not get out of Iraq now. Her position is that we have been lied into this war. Here is Cindy Sheehan.
I am even more convinced now that this aggression on Iraq was based on a lie of historic proportions and was blatantly unnecessary. The so-called Downing Street memo dated 23 July 2002 only confirms what I already suspected. The leadership of this country rushed us into an illegal invasion of another sovereign country on prefabricated and cherry-picked intelligence. Iraq was no threat to the United States of America, and the devastating sanctions and bombing raids against Iraq were working.
And now why George really doesn't want to meet with her, because here is where she lays out the devastating truth about why he really attacked Iraq.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency," end quote. It looks like George Bush was ready to lead this country into an avoidable war even before he became president.
And then she speaks about her son.
From the expose of the Downing Street memo and the conversations with George Bush from 1999, it seems like the invasion of Iraq and the deaths of so many innocent people were preordained. It appears that my boy Casey was given a death sentence even before he joined the Army in May of 2000.
And that's the true tragedy. And then you get Bill O'Reilly coming out and saying, oh, no, this is treason what she's doing.
I mean, I think Mrs. Sheehan bears some responsibility for this, and also for the responsibility of other American families who have lost sons and daughters in Iraq who feel that this kind of behavior borders on treasonous.
This is incredible. So, Paula, thanks for getting me started on that.
Thank you so much.
I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. And thanks for calling in. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Logan in New York City. Hey, Logan, what's up?
Hey, what's up? I'm just wondering, are these Republicans, are we dealing with, like, the same group of people from Nixon, or is this, like...
This is worse.
What I'm saying is it seems like the Republican Party has been sort of taken over by this group ever since Reagan, and it's like... It just keeps coming back. Like.
Yeah, there have been three major takeovers of the Republican Party. The first one was in the late 1870s. The Republican Party, which was founded in 1856 in Jackson, Michigan, was originally a reform party, an anti-slavery party, and an anti-corporate power party, and Abraham Lincoln, their first presidential candidate. And by the 1870s, they were being corrupted by the railroads, and by the late 1870s, they were gone. They had become the party of big business and inherited wealth, and and they became the party of the robber barons, you know, right up through the, and created the Great Depression with their insane economic policies leading up to, you know, Herbert Hoover, all, six consecutive massive tax cuts for the most wealthy in America, creating this towering pyramid of wealth that fell over in 1929. So there was that takeover. And then there was the takeover during the Nixon era, and actually it was the tail end of the Eisenhower administration, you know, charged being led by Richard Nixon, which was basically about power. And Nixon knew that in order to get that kind of power, he needed to bring in, number one, people who had no ethics, and number two, people who had a lot of money. And so, you know, for example, the 1960 campaign, Nixon was in charge of Cuba. He was the vice president at the time. He put together the Bay of Pigs invasion as an October surprise in 1960. The weather conspired against him. He wasn't able to pull it off, so Kennedy inherited this thing without even realizing it. But that's what Nixon was going to use to beat Kennedy. So that was the beginning of the more modern, the post-Eisenhower re-corruption of the party. And then as we moved into the later Nixon years, in the 70s, as Nixon as president, you had Rumsfeld and Cheney in Congress. Rumsfeld back in, he was in Congress for a while, working in the White House under the Ford administration. I believe that Rumsfeld was Secretary of Defense and Cheney was Chief of Staff, as I recall, for Jerry Ford. And then the influence of Leo Strauss and the neocons and this worldview of the ends justify the means. It's okay to lie. You have to have a national mythos, nationalism at all, you know, above all else. Use religion as a way of muddying the waters and seizing power and just this pure Machiavellianism, this Straussianism. Yeah, that's, I mean, that's where we're at now.
Yeah, but they don't have, I mean, there's just no chance of a McCain getting a nomination in that case. It's just, it's,
I think
it's
not.
Laughable.
I think not. I mean, look at what happened. McCain was way ahead of George W. Bush, and he goes into the South Carolina primary. This is in the year 2000. He goes into the South Carolina primary, and Karl Rove hires a company to do push polls, and they're calling, you know, they call tens of thousands of people all around South Carolina, registered Republicans, and say, you know, McCain has and his wife have adopted a child, I believe, from Bangladesh. She's rather dark-skinned. And he says, would you still vote for John McCain if you knew that he had a child out of wedlock with an African-American woman and then adopted her? And would you vote for John McCain if you knew that he had been suffering psychiatric problems from being a prisoner of war?
Right.
Would you vote for John McCain if you knew that his wife was schizophrenic? You know, these are called push polls. None of it was true. And yet thousands of people in South Carolina believed it. And all of a sudden, John McCain fell off the face of the earth. Yeah,
but
these
how
guys
come
are
this,
ruthless.
How come this doesn't enrage sensible Republicans? I just don't understand it.
I think it does. And I think a lot of sensible Republicans have left the Republican Party because they've been so enraged by it. That's, you know, it's really
Thanks
quite
lot,
clear
Tom.
To me. Yeah, you're welcome, Logan. Thanks for the call. You know, it's really quite clear to me that that's one of the major things that's going on is Republicans are fleeing the Republican Party. They're saying, enough. You know, we've had it. These guys are nuts. We're not going to put up with it anymore. But where are they going to go? Where are they going to go? And hopefully they will be going to the Democratic Party. And because the Democratic Party is actually starting to talk about the things that the old-fashioned Republicans were talking about back before it all got politicized. You know, during the Eisenhower administration, when the top marginal tax rate was 90% on millionaires and billionaires, when the restraints on corporate activity and put in place with the Sherman Antitrust Act in December of 1881 were still in power, but still in use, when CEOs typically made 30 to 50 times what their lowest-paid employees did instead of 500 times like now. So, you know, it's might come around again, 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. We're going to get back to your phone calls in just a few minutes. But first, we have Janet Bates with us in the studio. Janet Bates is a folk singer who has composed a beautiful new song, Mother's Day. She's here in Portland, Oregon. Janet Bates and the Instruments of Change is the group that she's with. They're performing at The Bite this afternoon at 1:30 to 2:15 in Oregon. $5 admission to that. And she has a great website, a couple of CDs, JanetBates.com. Hey, Janet, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you.
Glad to have you here. You have written a beautiful song, Mother's Day. Tell us very quickly, what is this song about?
It's essentially about being the mother of a soldier in Iraq and the sort of the game that you play. You hear about somebody dying there, and you rush to find out whether it's your your relative, and then when you find out that it's not, then you feel relieved, but then you go on to feel guilty and badly for the person that is the one that's feeling the pain today.
Yeah. It's a tough one. Okay, well, let's get right to the song. This is Janet Bates playing Mother's Day.
You read the news on Mother's Day, someone else's mother pays. You're so relieved at your reprieve, but today it's someone else's grief. The wheel of fortune turns around, now telling who's laying down. Those who hold the greatest stakes are lucky just to walk away. It's not a game that they can win, a grand illusion got them in. The winner doesn't play the game, but he'll take the prizes just the same. Prepared for the attack, you knew someone wasn't coming back. Now you count your lucky stars, but there's an empty bunker next to yours. The wheel of fortune turns around, now telling who's laying down. Those who hold the greatest stakes are lucky just to walk away. It's not a game that they can win, a grand illusion got them in. The winner doesn't play the game, but he'll take the prizes just the same. You read the news on Mother's Day, your stock's in Halliburton paid. You tell the folks down at the bank that you've got your government to thank. The wheel of fortune turns around, no telling who it's laying down. Those who hold the greatest stakes are lucky just to walk away. It's not a game that they can win, a grand illusion got them in. The winner doesn't play the game, but he'll take the prizes just the same. A soldier in a foreign land, his body lying in the sand. The letters in his pocket say, I love you, happy Mother's Day.
Oh, that's an extraordinarily powerful song. Thank you so much, Janet Bates. JanetBates.com, your website, right, Janet?
Yes, that's
okay,
right.
Okay, thank you. That's brilliant. You and your group, Janet Bates and the Instruments of Change, performing here in Portland, Oregon, right now, or this week, performing here in our studio, performing that song live. JanetBates.com, check it out. She has two CDs available there and some extraordinary music. Janet, thank you so much for showing up today.
Well, you're welcome. Thanks.
Yep. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense from the radical middle. Tom Hartman here with you, 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, TJ in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, TJ, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify one thing. Walmart, yeah, the commercial, my mother works at Walmart. She has benefits. They even have them for part-timers, for one. So that commercial is just way out of line. And thank God for Walmart. But anyways, I'm a Republican, okay? I was a Democrat. I left the Democratic Party for moral reasons. My mother raised five kids. We're a poor family. We were raised a poor family. So not all Republicans are rich. A lot of people that were Democrats left the Democratic Party when you guys started supporting the perversion. And I call it the party of perversion now. Take me off the air.
Why?
What's, excuse me?
Why? You just said take me off the air?
Yeah, well, you probably would take me off the air because whenever a person starts talking like I'm going to talk, you take them off the air.
Well, actually, no, I don't. I'm trying to understand what you're saying here, TJ. Is it because there are some people in the Democratic Party who think that gays should have civil rights that you're not willing to be part of the Democratic Party?
No, I'm not going to support the party of perversion. I will not do that.
Okay, well, what is the perversion? Just please explain to me. I don't
know. The perversion to me is using stem cell research, doing the same thing that Saddam Hussein did to his people after a baby would be massacred in an abortion. Now you want to use the baby for stem cell research?
Okay. So stem cell research is the perversion that you're talking about.
The homosexual lifestyle, do not teach that to kids in public schools.
Okay, let's take these things one at a time, TJ. If you want to would you like to have a conversation about this? I'm assuming that you would like to, that you called. Let's talk about stem cell research for just a second. I'm just trying to understand your position on this, because it's just marvelous that you called, because I've been hoping that somebody would call who could explain this to me. If you have an infertile couple, you have a man and a woman who are married and they want to have children and they can't do it because the woman's fallopian tubes, that those little tubes that connect the uterus and the ovaries, have been scarred up, usually by an infection that the woman had, you know, as a teenager or in early years. Usually it's a chlamydial infection. And the egg that comes out of the ovaries actually gets fertilized in the fallopian tubes. The sperm have to swim all the way up into there to fertilize that egg. And so women who have scar tissue in their fallopian tubes can't have babies. So they go into a clinic, and they started doing this 23 years ago, and the Catholic Church is officially opposed to this, by the way, so, you know, just as a caveat. They go into a clinic, and they put a needle into the ovaries, or however they do it, and they take out a couple of dozen, 10, 20, 30 of those eggs, put them in a Petri dish, get some sperm from the husband, you know, by the kind of semi-conventional method, you know, guys know about, and mix that in the Petri dish with those eggs, and now you've got 20 or 30 fertilized eggs in there, and they look at them all with a microscope, and they say, okay, this one looks like it's the best one, it's the most viable one. They take that one out, and they put that in that woman's uterus, where it will implant itself and grow and become a baby, and now she can have a baby, she couldn't have a baby before, and you've got 29 leftover eggs that have been fertilized. Now, for the last 23 years, what they've been doing with those leftover eggs is flushing them down the sink. These folks are suggesting, the stem cell research folks are suggesting, hey, those cells, those are made out of cells that can become any kind of cell in the body. You can take one of those fertilized eggs, and you can break a couple of the cells out of it and put it into the pancreas of a child who has type 1 diabetes. And because they're undifferentiated cells, they haven't yet become anything. They haven't formed yet into the spine or into the heart or into the brain. They will become the kind of tissue that they're surrounded by, and it will regenerate the pancreas of that child, and that child will no longer have type 1 diabetes. What's wrong with that? TJ? I guess we've lost TJ. Well, you know, I'm sorry. Maybe, you know, some Republican, please call and explain this to me. I don't get it. You know, what's wrong with that? It seems to me like that's saving life. Steven in Atlanta, you're live and on the air with us. Hey, Steven, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I wanted to compliment your singer that you had on, and she did a great job. She's a brave woman. And
Isn't she marvelous?
Yeah, it sounded like the classic 60s protest song, didn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah, and she's just great. They came in and did our morning show here. I do a local show in Portland, Oregon, and because they're playing locally, you know, they came in and played, and it was just so good. I said, you got to stick around and do our national show. This is so JanetBates.com is her website.
Yeah, it reminds me of the Simpsons episode where Lisa sings the protest song about the power plant.
We'll march till we drop, the girls and the fellas. We'll fight till the death or else fold like umbrellas.
Okay, alrighty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's pretty great stuff. Anyway, keep up all your great work, Tom, and Cindy Sheehan is another brave woman. And
I agree.
Hopefully we can knock some sense into these idiots.
Yeah, well, or we can bring them around to our way of viewing. I mean, that's the really simple thing. Thank you, Stephen. I appreciate it. And here's the challenge. For example, there was a study that just came out that suggests, you know, what are the most liberal cities in America? Okay. Portland is a more liberal city than Atlanta or Los Angeles, but not as liberal as Seattle, New York, or Boston, according to a study by the Bay Area Center for Voting Research. Portland is number 29 in the nation's list. This, of course, is in today's Portland newspaper. Detroit tops the center of the list as the most liberal city. Provo, Utah, the most conservative. They rank 237 American cities with populations over 100,000. My question, I went to their website. I spent a fair amount of time on their website, actually, this morning, the Bay Area Center for Voting Research, trying to figure out what are the questions that you use to find out if somebody's liberal. I mean, how do you determine that? Because, you know, I mean, if you look historically at the difference between liberal and conservative, the conservatives historically, if you go back, the British conservatives, Sir Edmund Burke, the founder of modern conservative thought, the guy that Barry Goldwater quotes, the guy that William F. Buckley quotes, the guy, you know, the guy that Russell Kirk, who in 1953 wrote The Conservative Mind, which is the book that founded the modern conservative movement, you know, the post-1950 conservative movement. Sir Edmund Burke, back in the 1770s, in a dialogue, in a long series of letters between him and one of the founders of the modern liberal movement, Thomas Paine, Sir Edmund Burke, said, it does me no harm if a man is allowed to engage in such a servile profession as a tallow maker or a waiter, right? A tallow maker, a candle maker. He said, however, a hairdresser. He said, however, it does society great violence if such a man is allowed to engage, to participate in governance, in other words, allowed to vote. The traditional conservative view, the traditional British conservative view, was you have to have a rule by a small number of people. You have to have a ruling elite. They are trained to rule. They understand the power, how power works. If you just throw open the doors, you know, like in the early days of the French Revolution, you're going to end up with the same kind of disastrous results as the French Revolution. You're going to end up with the terrors. You're going to end up with mob rule. It's going to be anarchy. And so you have to have this ruling elite. And this is the debate that has been going on for a long, long time. And the British thought that it should be a hereditary ruling elite. And the American conservatives, like John Adams and Alexander Hamilton, in the early days, believed that the ruling elite should be a meritocratic ruling elite. That is, they should be the smartest among us, and or the wealthiest among us, who had accumulated the wealth by some means other than inheritance. You'll notice there are no family fortunes left over from the George Washington family or the Thomas Jefferson family or the James Madison family, any of them, because of the inheritance laws that came into place over time, you know, and so anyhow, we only saw American dynasties emerge in the 1870s. So what this is the big cleavage point between liberals who, like Thomas Paine, like George Washington, like Thomas Jefferson, like James Madison, who believed that, no, in fact, you should allow all the people to rule. And the conservatives, like John Adams and Alexander Hamilton, who said, no, there has to be a small ruling elite. And the compromise in the early days was that the Senate would represent the ruling elite, and they would be appointed by the states. You wouldn't be allowed to vote for your senator, but the House of Representatives would be to quote John Adams, the rabble could vote for the House. And that was the compromise until 1917, when we allowed direct election of the Senate. And out of this, you know, the traditional liberal concepts are protecting the commons. There are things that are in common that we all share in common. The liberals, progressives say things like our roads, our police departments, our fire departments, our public education systems, our air, our water. These are things that we hold in common, and we administer them through that thing that of common governance called our government, which is us. It's not a them. It's not an it. It's us, if we participate in it, which we must do. So, number one, protect the commons. Conservatives, on the other hand, say, no, privatize the commons. Sell off the water system, sell off the power system, sell off the phone systems, sell it all off. Sell off the schools, vouchers, privatize it all, let corporations run it. Privatize the healthcare system. And, you know, that's the debate. Individual rights. liberals historically have taken the position that the Bill of Rights means exactly what the Bill of Rights says. The Fourth Amendment, for example, you have the right to privacy. Actually, the Bill of Rights doesn't use the word privacy because in 1787, when the Bill of Rights was written, or 1788, when it was written and proposes an amendment to the Constitution, the word privacy meant toilet functions. But, you know, they said it in the same, they said that, you know, to be secure in your person's papers and home, same thing. Conservatives give up some privacy, give up those rights in exchange for safety. Public education and infrastructure. Liberals, progressives are in favor of public education and a strong national infrastructure. Conservatives say, no, all that stuff should be privatized. Let the captains of the industry worry about that. They're rich, they're powerful, they will run things. See, you have to keep in mind, when conservatives say, government's too big, make it smaller. You know, it sounds really nice. You know, the Department of Motor Vehicles is always a pain in the butt to deal with. Government bureaucrats are always easy to kick around. But they never talk about the corporate bureaucrats. They never talk about the bureaucrats that you have to deal with your insurance company when you're trying to get a claim paid. But in any case, you know, they say, you know, big government is too big, make it smaller. It sounds nice. But the problem is that in most of these areas that have to do with the commons, if you do away with government, which is responsive to us, we can change. There's a power vacuum. It's going to be filled by something or somebody. And of course, what they have in mind that they're not saying, the second half of the sentence is, and let us take it over. Remember the old Harry and Louise ads against Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton's national health care program? Oh, look at Harry. You know, Harry, look at this. Hillary Clinton wants to tell us what doctors we can choose. Oh, we can't allow the government to tell us what doctors we can choose. First of all, that was never part of the proposal. And secondly, really the question is, who do you want paying for your doctors? Who do you want administering your health care? Do you want it to be an agency that's responsive to the voters, where you can throw the bums out at the ballot box? Or do you want it to be a private for-profit corporation that if you call them up and complain, they can hang up on you and there's no recourse? Which would you rather have? Progressives historically have believed in a non-interventionist foreign policy. Ironically, this has also been the position of the Republican Party for most of its history. Progressives believe in balanced budget and fiscal sanity. This is also, you know, these are things that Democrats and Republicans traditionally have agreed on. But the modern Republican Party has got into this very aggressive foreign policy and thrown balanced budgets to the wind. As Dick Cheney says, Ronald Reagan proved to us deficits don't matter. Well, I'm sorry, they do matter. And we're paying $160 billion this year in interest on the money that Ronald Reagan borrowed back in the early 1980s just to make the economy look good. Progressives believe in clean air, pure water, safe food, and that we, the people, collectively should have some say in making sure that that's the case. Conservatives say, no, take apart those federal agencies, those unnecessary bureaucratic regulations that protect we, the people. Down in Texas, as governor, George Bush turned pollution controls for the factories, for the chemical factories and the oil refineries from mandatory to voluntary. What do they get? The dirtiest air in the country. Progressives view health care as a right, not a privilege. That health care should be something that, you know, as a member of society, we're going to take care of our own. Progressives say, you know, we agree with Jesus in Matthew 25, where he said, you know, and his disciples came and said, how do we get to heaven? And he said, you know, in the end days, you know, the Son of Man will sit there, you know, he's going to sit there on his throne, he's going to divide the sheep from the goats, right? The sheep are going to go to heaven, the goats are going to go to hell. And those sheep are the ones, he says, when I was naked, you clothed me. When I was hungry, you fed me. When I was thirsty, you gave me drink. When I was in prison, you visited me. When I was sick, you took care of me. And the disciples look around and go, holy cow, we're in trouble. Because, he's, you know, and they say to him, you know, we never saw you hungry. We never saw you naked. We never saw you thirsty. How could we have done this for you? How can we get into heaven if we never helped you out? And Jesus says to them, as you did to the least of these, my brethren, you did unto me. That's the progressive perspective. The conservative perspective, the least of them, screw them. It's, you know, very simple. If you can boil it down to that. Health care is a right. Trade policies that favor America before multinational corporations, progressive position. The conservative position, trade policies that favor multinational corporations before America. Ship our jobs overseas. Export our jobs. Send our factories to China. That's fine. That's the, you know, the Bush administration actively and aggressively promoting that. The liberal or progressive agenda, business policies, that is rules for the game of business, that favor communities over multi-state corporations. So if a community decides that it doesn't want a Walmart, it can say, no, you can't come in here. We'd rather have, you know, 30 or 40 small locally owned businesses where the money stays local and local families own these businesses and entrepreneurs have opportunities. Even if we have to pay a little more, we're going to be making a little more in salaries because we're working for us in this community rather than have every night at midnight somebody push a button and all the money come vacuum cleaned out of our community and sent down to Bentonville, Arkansas. Progressives say local communities should have some power in that. Conservatives say, no, multi-state corporations should have the power to tell local communities, hey, you don't like it? Tough. We're here. Progressives oppose the privatization of the vote. We say, what on earth are we doing having private for-profit corporations counting our votes and telling us how we voted? That should not be something that was privatized. Progressives say human rights are for human beings and not for corporations. The Bill of Rights is pretty specific. It's about people. And progressives believe in a meritocracy, that everybody is born with an equal opportunity to rise as far as they can. This is what Jefferson meant when he wrote in the Declaration of Independence, all men are born equal, with equal opportunity. And if somebody is born with less than equal opportunity as a result of, say, 200 years of slavery, and it's harder for them to get into college, then we'll give them a little help to make that, to level the playing field for them. 10 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Hang on to those dreams.
Hold on tight to your dream.
Yes, dreaming of an egalitarian America. An America where working people start to figure out that so-called conservatives who are all in favor of shipping their jobs overseas, who are robbing them blind, who are spending huge deficit spending so that their children and grandchildren are going to end up paying the bill, and then throw them a little red meat saying, it's all about abortion. It's all about gays. That they're being played for suckers. That people will realize that they're being played for suckers by these cons. And it is just so obvious. Bush also made a law in Texas that hospitals can decide to pull the plug on life support if a client did not have sufficient funding, by the way. One of the folks in the chat room points out to me. Armin in Florida on the line with us. Hey, Armin, what's in your mind today?
You ought to see the opulent homes these so-called conservatives own on the waterfront down here in Florida. It would just amaze you.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, there's the conservatives who understand why they're conservative. You've got the millionaires and billionaires. And then there's the conservatives who think that they're conservative because it has to do with what they call morality. They've clearly never read the New Testament, or, you know, most of them who are Christian. And really it's that they're afraid of gays, or they think that you know, abortion should be outlawed. And they don't get it. That the conservatives are just using that stuff as a smokescreen to pick their pockets.
Exactly. And it always helps, too, when you own the media, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it definitely does. Thanks a lot, Armin, for making that point. It's well said. Will in Pittsburgh. Hey, Will, what's up?
Tom, how are you? By the way, thank you, Dr. Kinsey. You lost TJ from Pittsburgh when you mentioned fallopian tubes.
There you go. I don't know when he dropped off. I wasn't watching the call screening software here, so I don't know when he hung up on me. Whether it was in the middle of my rant or when I said, hey, what's up, you know, but anyhow, he got me started, so.
Tell you what, I thank the world of you for giving him the opportunity to try and explain what the heck he was trying to explain. I still don't get it. You know what I mean, Tom?
Yeah, I if somebody would explain it to me in a way that makes sense to me, I may even change my mind. I've done that many times in my life. So, you know, it's a very straightforward process. Will, thanks a lot for the call, and, you know, good to hear from you. I appreciate it. We've got to wrap up this hour, and we'll be back. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the true people's radio. The pill that will help you escape the matrix. Yes, that pill.
have been listening to the Tom Hartman Program, check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
A.org.
Exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to West Virginia, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on radiopower.org, whiterosesociety.org, podcasting on whiterosesociety.org, and Apple's iTunes. And, of course, in 29 states on cable systems with CRN Digital. Welcome back to our program. In just a few minutes, we're going to be speaking with David Kirby about Thimerosal, vaccines, and autism. But first, we've had a few callers on hold for a while here. I want to just respectfully get to them here. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Gary, what's on your mind?
Hello, Tom. A few thoughts, if I may. I try to keep it brief.
Sure.
You can't be strong abroad if we're weak at home. I think that's fundamentally number one to me.
Yeah, that's one of the points that needs to be made over and over and over again, because we have hollowed out with the conservative economic policies.
And they're going to string us out.
Going back to Reagan, they've hollowed out our infrastructure.
And they're going to string us out verbally in debates, if you will. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
We need to just be very concise, if you will.
Yeah.
This is my opinion. And then I think what we need to realize is that we're not to have the best opportunity to win the next election. We can't use tack with Republicans. There's an old saying, you can't use tack with Republicans. Most Republicans, I'm going to put most in there to be fair. Most Republicans are hogs. You got to take a stick and hit them on the damn snout.
Okay, Gary.
And thirdly, I know I could get to number three if I could get that one across. Maybe I'd have a shot at it. Ain't that a great one? It's not mine, but it's one of my favorites.
You know, the reality is I don't think that that's true of most Republicans. I think it's true of most of the Republicans in the media. But,
well,
you know, I mean, my parents are Republicans, and, you know, I can tell you, you know, up close and personal, my father has my picture shaking hands with the Pope next to a picture of George W. Bush.
Okay, well,
so,
I think, yeah.
I'm not willing to indict all, honest to God, I'm not
is
willing to
right?
indict all Republicans.
Yeah.
I worked on Barry Goldwater's campaign in 1964. My dad was in the county Republicans, you know, in Michigan, and I was 13 years old, I went door to door for Barry Goldwater. I've been inside that. There's a lot of good people in that party.
I'm like a parachute, but it doesn't function unless it's open. I think there are a lot of good Republicans out there.
Yeah.
But I think the bottom...
They need to take their party back is the bottom line here.
Not
Gary. What's your third point? I got to move along.
Can I say one more thing?
Yes, that's what I... Please do.
Back in the 1980s, and maybe in the future you could look this up or somebody could. This is a fact. During the 1980s, 1%... 1% got 70% of the income gains. I'd like to know what that is from 2000 to 2005. That is an absolute fact.
Yeah,
1%.
It would be interesting to know. Unfortunately, your statistics are always going to be about 3 years old. But
1% got, think of that, 1% got 70% of
the
income gains.
Yeah, and it was the top 1%. Yep. Gary,
okay,
good
thank
point.
You.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate your calling in. Jason in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Jason, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, hey, I'll be so glad when we get you for that third hour. We've only got you 2 hours here.
Okay.
That third hour, we got to get you.
There you go.
I can't hear myself.
That's fine, Jason. I don't want to discuss my affiliates on the air. But what's on your mind?
Anyway, just real quick, and I hate to pile on TJ, but and just to correct you, this will be a first, just to correct you, you didn't lose him. He lost himself when he went conservative or went Republican.
Yeah.
But just to kind of, you know, rebut some of his claims, there was a really great analogy that you mentioned, you know, when you were pointing out the differences between conservatives and liberals. And, you know, the one about where, lending or extending a helping hand to some people who weren't as equal in the case of slavery.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is, like, one of the things I think that conservatives, it really burns them, because they feel like they're forced to, extend a hand to not just African-Americans, but, you know, people who don't have the same advantage or opportunity.
Well, and the reality is, Jason, that they are forced to, and because we as a society have agreed on doing that, and you know, any use of government is a use of force, and we have to acknowledge that and use it carefully. But the reality is that if one of the ideals of America is that we are all born equal, and at the same time, the reality is that our history shows that some of us are less equal than others, and by equal we mean with equal opportunity to get it out of the gate, you know, to have success in life, then for those who are born less equal than others, we have an obligation to make it up to them at some point. And that's what affirmative action is all about, you know. And ideally, at some point, it would all go away because it would be resolved. But, you know, nobody, no thinking person, no rational person today can say that we've achieved either racial equality or gender equality in the United States. I'm sorry. It's just not real.
Yep. And just one more point. And, and in the converse of what we're just talking about, we are forced to accommodate, like, the rich, to help them become richer, by allowing them to rewrite tax laws and whatnot so that they get a return on every dime, every penny of their money.
Oh, yeah.
On this side, we only get a minute percentage of our tax dollars back.
Well, and the biggest...
I'm talking about individual state, you know, local, whatever.
Yeah, and the biggest example of that, Jason, and well said, the biggest example of that is the last Bush tax cut, which says that if you earn your living working for a living, you're going to pay, you know, a top tax rate in the 30% range. But if you earn your living and you have to pay Social Security income tax in the first $90,000, if you earn your living sitting on your butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive in the mail, your maximum tax rate is 15%. You don't have to pay any Social Security at all. And that's Bush's world. I mean, that's their idea. Jason, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate
all right.
it. Good to
thanks
hear from you. Yeah, thanks. Susan in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, Susan, what's on your mind today?
Two things. First, hello. Second, thank you for last hours of Ancient Sunlight. It's very enlightening.
Oh, you're welcome. Writing that book was a real challenge because I had to go through there's some really awful information in that book, and, you know, hopefully it ends. The last third of it is a pretty hopeful part of the book, but
that's the part I'm up to.
Yeah, there you go. But boy, going through the state of the world stuff, it took me about 2 years to write that
book. Everyone should read it. Everyone should read it.
Thank you.
Everyone listening has to read that book. I give it to all my friends. I buy it and give it out.
Well, my publisher thanks you. Random House tips their hat to you.
The point I'd like to make is I'm concerned about the voting machines.
Yes.
I know we have to vote out the powers that are in now. Now, how do we do it with voting machines that are corrupt and controlled by the powers that are controlling it?
Well, it's the same as you do with any corrupt system, whether it's a system that's been corrupted by, the corruption of slavery, the corruption of sexism, you know, the inability of women to vote before the 1920s, on and on, you know, all the ills of society. You hold it up to the light. You speak out about it and you make it very, very public and very well known. Frankly, I think one of the things that's going to cause the voting machines to go down the tubes is if we can convince conservatives that Democrats have figured out how to rig the voting machines. and so I'm waiting for that conspiracy theory to appear on a conservative website. Anyhow, yeah, Susan, thanks a lot for the call. Great to
bye
hear
bye,
from
thank
you.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. David Kirby is with us. David is suggesting every 166 children in the United States has autism. What's causing this epidemic? David is suggesting that it may have something to do with thimerosal, an additive that contains mercury that's in vaccines. David, welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot, Tom. How are you?
I'm great. What's a website, first of all, David, where people can find out more about the work that you're doing?
My website is evidenceofharm.com, and there's a lot on there, including a lot of that's been published in the media recently on this controversy. And pretty soon I'll be posting all the science that I use to write my book, and I hope people will take a look and weigh both sides of the evidence here and make their own conclusions.
Great. And your book is also titled Evidence of Harm, Mercury and Vaccines and the Autism Epidemic, a Medical Controversy. I'm assuming, David, that you're familiar with the article that referenced you rather heavily by Arthur Allen that was in Slate, I believe it was?
Yes.
He suggests that most of the actual studies that have been published don't show a connection between mercury and vaccines and the autism. You're suggesting that they do. What accounts for that difference?
Well, as published, he's correct. They do not. And that's basically what the Institute of Medicine used to make their decision and issue their ruling, that there was no connection between thimerosal and autism. Couple of problems with that. First of all, you can neither prove nor disprove causation based on epidemiology alone. In other words, large population studies. You have to do the biology. You have to do the clinical work, the animal models. You have to look in the blood and cells and brains of these children.
Yeah, but you can get a pretty good idea. I mean, we discovered that when women started smoking, lung cancer rates went up. When men were smoking, cancer, you know, when people started working with asbestos, we got mesothelioma.
You definitely get a good idea. And again, I mean, Arthur called it as he saw it, and if you look at these studies in their final published form, no, there's very little evidence of a link between thimerosal and autism. But if you go a little bit deeper and you look at these studies, all five of them have serious problems with them. Some have serious questions involved. Some are clearly flawed. I mean, we can talk about them. The one that came out of Denmark is probably the easiest to figure out what's wrong with it, or according to critics of it, and I consider myself one of them. This study looked at children born in Denmark. Denmark removed mercury from its vaccines in 1992, and they tracked the rate of autism in that country. And prior to 1992, it was extremely low and very flat. They removed the mercury in 1992, and according to this report, the rates of autism, the number of cases in that country, started to go up exponentially. And if you look at the chart, it looks like, wow, they removed the mercury and autism went up. Well, first of all, if that were really true, why are we taking mercury out of vaccines if it protects against autism, which would be one implication of that. But second of all, when you read the methodology, and the authors themselves admitted that this may have spuriously increased the number of cases in Denmark, in 1995, Denmark changed the way it took tracked of autism cases in that country. Prior to that time, they had only looked at inpatient cases, children that were diagnosed in a hospital setting. That's pretty unusual with autism. It's only about 13% of the cases in Denmark. After 1995, the registry changed, and they started counting all children diagnosed everywhere in the country, doctor's offices, outpatient clinics, etc. And of course the number went way up, because now they were counting 100% of the cases rather than just 13% of the cases. So that's just one example of a study that when people say it's flawed.
But still they were having autism. David Kirby, I'm curious if you think the two things that have occurred to me that might be, say, coexistent with the problems with thimerosal are, number one, environmental mercury.
Absolutely.
And genetic vulnerability thereto. And the second is that we know that rubella can cause autism, and we're inoculating kids against rubella with vaccines that contain killed rubella virus. Could it be that they're responding to the vaccine itself rather than the preservative?
Yeah, well, that has been one theory. The rubella virus actually is not killed. It's attenuated, but it is still alive.
Even worse.
No, there really is no evidence to suggest that vaccines in and of themselves cause autism, and I'm not anti-vaccine by any means. There is the vaccine, the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. And by the way, you're right, that a woman's exposure to rubella early in pregnancy can cause autism.
Right.
Thimerosal is not the only cause of autism.
Right. David, we have to take a break for just a minute here. If you can you stick around?
Absolutely.
Great. We're going to take a four-minute break here. We're going to come back on the other side talking with David Kirby about thimerosal and autism.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We are speaking with David Kirby. And David, we've been talking about the research that suggests that there's not a link between vaccines and autism, or between thimerosal, if
correct.
That's the correct pronunciation, and autism. What is the evidence that there is a link?
Well, again, it's more on the biological side when you look at animal models, clinical studies, and at the children itself. Basically, we know that children with autism have higher levels of mercury in their systems than children without autism. They are retaining the mercury to which they have been exposed, and that probably is not just from vaccines. You're right, it's from maternal fish consumption. It's from air pollution from coal-fired plants. It's also from dental amalgams. We know that these children have a different genetic makeup, it would seem, than typical children, and as a result of that, they are unable to produce or seem to have a deficiency in certain sulfur-based proteins, glutathione being the most important. Sulfur has a natural affinity with mercury. It binds with heavy metals and helps us excrete them from our system.
Right. I remember maybe it was about 2 years ago, I think it was, in Science News, there was an article about how they found that autistic kids seem to have less mercury in their hair, which would indicate that, you know, usually heavy metals in the hair indicate that the heavy metals are in the bloodstream. And that initially caused them to think that these kids had less exposure to mercury. And then they did blood serum tests and found that they actually had more mercury in their blood, that they weren't excreting it, and that there seems to be a genetic predisposition to this.
Yes, that's pretty much how it happened. And that study has since been replicated, including at places like MIT. That would be part of the – that is consistent with this whole theory.
So in that case, then, it's not just thimerosal that we have to be worried about. I mean, there's mercury is all over the place, and George Bush wants us to have more of it. With his Clear Skies initiatives, he's actually increasing the amount of mercury that's being pumped into the air by our power plants.
Well, it's interesting you should say that. A recent study out of the University of Texas, of all places, showed that children in that state who live closer to a coal-fired power plant had a higher risk of autism, a significantly higher risk of autism. Now, all these kids, or most of them, conceivably or theoretically, were vaccinated, whether they were near a power plant or not, and yet the addition of that extra mercury in emissions may have pushed kids in those school districts into higher levels of autism.
Right. So what we're talking about is mercury load here, not just thimerosal.
That's correct. Although thimerosal was a significant load of mercury at a very significant time in life, from birth until about, you know, a year or so, and many kids receive thimerosal prenatally in the form of an immune globulin called Ro-D. The brand name was normally called Rogam. That contained much more mercury than found in any vaccine, and of course that was a prenatal exposure.
Right. We have about a minute left here. We're speaking with David Kirby. David, your book Evidence of Harm and your website evidenceofharm.com, right? Okay. What can people do about this information? Where is this going?
Well, this is going to Washington, and it's already there.
I mean, didn't Bill Frist insert something into one of the bills that said you can't sue vaccine companies?
Yes, but that was rescinded because of parental pressure. This story is really about the parents. That's what my book is based on. They went to the scientific community. The scientific community rejected their claims and dismissed them. So they went to the political establishment. And there are people in both parties on Capitol Hill right now working very hard on this issue. And this fall, we should see investigations and possibly even hearings on the Senate side. I've been to Washington. I've met with many top-level people there in Congress and even in HHS. They take this seriously, and there are some serious accusations out there.
Well, you've got a few members of Congress who have autistic kids in their families, and they believe that it had to do with vaccines.
One does, one doesn't. Dan Burton from Indiana, probably no fan of this show, is a far-right Republican from Indiana, and his grandson has autism. The other one is Dave Weldon, also a very conservative Republican from Florida, who has no personal connection to the story, but he is an MD.
Yeah, and he thinks that there's no problem.
No, he thinks there is seriously a possible connection.
Oh, interesting. Okay. David Kirby, the website evidenceofharm.com, the book Evidence of Harm, Mercury and Vaccines and the Autism Epidemic, a Medical Controversy. David, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
I do appreciate it very much. You're doing good work. Keep it up. Keep spreading the word. 29 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So you spin to the right, then spin to the right, then spin to the right again.
Ah, Mr. O'Reilly,
then you spin
yes.
Clockwise, spin to the starboard, spin to the right, and then you move a little bit abrupter. You're our nation's finest interrupter. Yours is the last word and first word. all the words in between, and a rude outburst word.
And welcome back.
Yes. Put the bull in bully.
Well, yeah, okay. Let's, you know, the actual real live clip. I mean, you know, might as well actually hear the real thing here, you know.
Well, the shut up line has happened only once in 6 years.
Want to know what
shut
I'm
up.
Doing?
Shut up. Ask me to shut up about sex.
What?
Listen, cut his mic.
No,
hey,
that's
shut
not...
up.
No,
you had
shut
your
up.
35 minutes. Shut up.
And it is our duty as loyal Americans to shut up and shut up publicly. We expect every American to support our military, and if they can't do that, to shut up. Okay. So you keep your mouth shut.
In a democracy, you don't have to shut up. Speak up.
There you go. Well said. Speaking up, Ellen Ratner with us. Hey, Ellen.
Hey, how you doing? Well, listen, two interesting sort of veins I'm going to go on today.
Okay.
First of all, there was a briefing at the Pentagon this morning, and they're saying now that they are partnering with Iraqis, and they have, listen to this, two or three regiments are ready to operate independently of the Iraqis. Well, is it two or is it three?
And how many folks are in a regiment?
That's a very good question. I don't know.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I'm not, yeah.
But they said that they are also needing 9 to 10 are needed, and it takes 6 months to train each one. They hope, they say, to train all 10 by year's end. But
somehow that doesn't add up.
It doesn't. Congratulations.
Okay, I won the prize.
you ding, ding, ding. Tom Hartman gets it.
Yep.
They're also saying that there's 25 to 30 contractors are used to transport supplies. Well, they're the Pentagon. They don't know whether it's 25 or whether it's 30. They are also saying that they are remaining within secure zones. They provide logistics. They did say that there are increased IED attacks within the triangle, but that nothing has really changed in terms of the insurgent tactics or their areas, but they said despite the number of increase in attacks, supply transportation hasn't been disrupted. So that's the good news. There's been an increase in attacks, but we haven't.
Well, they're in their death throes, Ellen.
Right.
That's how you know that you're winning, is because they kill more of you. Yeah. Now, what baffles me is how do we know when we're losing?
Just amazing.
How do we, you know, as far as I know, nobody has ever asked Scotty McClellan. Scotty, we understand that the way that we know we're winning in Iraq is because more and more of our soldiers are being engaged in combat. How would we know if we were losing?
Well, that, I mean, what they will say is there's no such option. I can tell you what Scott McClellan will say. There's no such option as losing.
Right.
We have the Iraqi constitution in front of us, et cetera.
Yeah, yeah. And truth be told, if the Iraqi constitution works out and if a democracy can come out of this, that will be some lemonade to be made out of this lemon at a horrific price in blood, in gold, in treasure, national treasure, $300 billion, over 100,000 dead human beings, including over 1,800 Americans. I mean, the price will have been, in the minds, I think, of most Americans, far too high. But still, a democracy would be a fine thing to happen in Iraq. But even that's still in question.
That's still in question. Meanwhile, as you know, I report to a lot of right-wing stations.
Yes.
And let me just tell you what their agenda is right now. They're after, of course, our Gold Star mom, because Cindy Sheehan, because they're saying that her family's against her. They're now going on about the NARAL ad. They're saying that the reason that the 9/11 Commission did not report that information that they got from the Pentagon was all because of politics. They're also saying that, you know, Clinton has just gone towards the middle, which they may be right about, to support his wife.
I'll go along with them on that.
Right, I will go along with them on that one. But that is really what they are. They are going after this 9/11 business like nothing you've ever seen.
Yeah, yeah, interesting. The 9/11 business. You mean the 9/11 Commission, the Department of, because it happened while Clinton was president.
Well, that's one reason.
And blame it on Clinton.
They're saying that the commissioners were in conspiracy not to report this.
Oh, so it's all Lee Hamilton's fault.
That's right.
Yeah, it couldn't be Thomas Keene.
No.
Not a chance.
I mean, I've pointed out to them that it's a bipartisan commission, but they're just not buying it.
And the chairman is a Republican.
Right.
Yeah.
You got it.
They're not going to go there. Oh, well.
Oh, and the other thing, of course, that everybody is really pushing is the Family Research Council is doing that event at the Baptist Church on Sunday to support Judge Roberts.
Yeah. And, the Justice Sunday 2 that they decided Bill Frist couldn't speak yet because he wasn't pure enough.
Right. And,
so they get Tom DeLay, whose best friend just got indicted for a case that involves not just a $23 million missing dollars, but a murder.
They won't mention him in the murder. But the other thing they're doing is the right wing is dispatching 15 of Judge Roberts' friends, colleagues, and legal experts. They're going to go to 14 states beginning today to push for what they're calling fairness during the Supreme Court hearings. They have all these folks that they are doing. Actually, they're even going to be doing a conference call on Monday about this.
You know, I don't think they even need to do it. I think the Democrats have, so many of the Democrats in Congress.
Oh, they've capitulated.
Yeah, they have the beaten spouse syndrome. You know, they're just, please don't hit me again. I'll be nice. Please don't hit me again. And Republicans are going, whack, you know, and oh, please don't hit me again. And it's just, it's painful to watch.
It's very painful to watch.
I keep wanting to grab various Democrats and just shake them and say, hey, wake up! Come on! You know, look at what Bernie Sanders is doing. He gets out there, he says, hey, black is black, white is white, up is up, down is down. It's not the opposite like the Republicans have been telling you. And everybody goes, oh, wow, he's telling the truth. I think I'll vote for him.
And exactly.
Incredible. I go on. Ellen, thank you for the insightful report from Washington, D.C.
Right.
I hope you have a wonderful weekend.
You too, and I'll talk to you on Monday.
Okay, great. Yep, we'll talk to you on Monday. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service from Washington, D.C. Just another example of how, I started to say how the Republican Party, but really, to tell the truth, which I always try to do. In fact, I'm always suspicious of people who say to me, there was a guy, a salesman the other day, and I asked him a question, and he says, well, to tell you the truth, when do you not tell me? You mean the other time you weren't telling me the truth? But in any case, to tell the truth, the reality is this is, the Democratic Party is guilty of playing politics just like the Republican Party. I mean, let's just acknowledge that right up front. The problem that we have is that the Republicans have been in power long enough, and they were brought to power by people who are ruthless enough that the abuse of that power has exceeded anything that we've seen by the Democrats, certainly in my lifetime, and I think in my father and my parents and my grandparents' lifetimes as well. I mean, the Democratic abuse of power was wild and substantial in the era from 1830 to, say, the 1880s. And in the South, certainly right up until the 1960s. But still, what's going on with the Republicans is just off the scale. And this is just another example of it. This article, John Solomon in the Associated Press wrote this. The headline, GOP paying legal bills of Bush official. Despite a zero-tolerance policy on tampering with voters, right?
Our official policy, we don't tamper with votes.
Yes, sir, don't tamper with votes. Ralph, call somebody and tell them to tamper with some votes. I got some votes here in the old voting machine. We're going to move them from left to right and from right to left. But despite a zero-tolerance policy on tampering with voters, the Republican Party has quietly paid hundreds of thousands of dollars to provide private defense lawyers for a former Bush campaign official charged with conspiring to keep Democrats from voting in New Hampshire. James Tobin was the chairman for New England in 2004 for George W. Bush. And he's now been charged with four felonies that suggest that a GOP consultant in Virginia and one of the state leaders of the Republican Party in New Hampshire conspired to jam the phone banks, the get-out-the-vote phone banks, that the labor unions and the Democratic Party were using in the state of New Hampshire in the year 2002, in November 2002. How did they do this? The telephone firm was paid to make repeated hang-up phone calls to overwhelm the phone banks in New Hampshire. Odds are, frankly, that what they did is they probably did it with computers and modems, and you just tell the modem, you know, dial this number. You know, or you could even set up a fax machine, dial this number, and automatically redial every 5 seconds if you don't get through. And so, you know, the phone banks, the phone rings, they answer it, it goes beep, 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 they hang up, the machine auto-dials, hey, didn't send the fax, or it didn't connect with the modem, and over and over and over again. And so what it does is it wipes out the phone banks. Nobody can get in, nobody can get out. And it was a very close race. And it was won by a whisker by the Republican, John Sununu, as a result, apparently, of this criminal conspiracy. So the Republicans are paying off the criminals who conspired. Very simple. At the same time that this guy, by the way, Tobin, this guy that has been charged now, James Tobin, he was the RNC's New England regional director, and then in 2004 he became part of George W. Bush's 2004 re-election campaign. They've already had two people now plead guilty in this, and they're cooperating with the prosecutors. And Tobin's indictment, this is from the AP, Tobin's indictment accuses him of specifically calling the GOP consultant to get a telephone firm to help in the scheme. The object of the conspiracy, this is language from the indictment, issued by a federal grand jury on May 18th. The object of the conspiracy was to deprive inhabitants of New Hampshire, and more particularly qualified voters, of their federally secured right to vote. Now, you would say, oh, you know, that must be an aberration. That must be strange. I mean, you know, this must just be some renegade guy. Ever heard of Paul Weyrich? Paul Weyrich, or as his ancestors would have pronounced it, Weyrich. Paul Weyrich is the guy who claims credit for Ronald Reagan. I mean, he's got a book out. I believe it's called something like The New Media. And it's about, he's the guy who says that, you know, he developed this whole fundraising apparatus, this whole huge fundraising apparatus to raise money using direct mail for Ronald Reagan. And he says that, and to get out the vote. And he claims that he was one of the architects of the Reagan Revolution and that he was responsible for the whole conservative landslide that took over America in the 80s and 90s, you know, shipping all our jobs overseas, cutting virtually in half the average income of families across the United States, throwing us into debt. He's very proud of this. And how did he do it? Well, here's Paul Weyrich. Now, listen carefully to this. This is one of the Republican leaders. Here's Paul Weyrich speaking before a congregation. You know, the Republicans like to conflate religion and politics. Speaking before a Republican congregation. Back about 2 years ago.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
And so this was years ago, this guy, Paul Weyrich, the guy who's the architect of the modern, over the last 25 years, saying, our job as Republicans is to drive down the vote. And then at the same time, now we've got Paul Tobin in New Hampshire being indicted for driving down the vote, for, you know, busting up the Democratic Party's get-out-the-vote phone banks, where they're calling people up and saying, hey, you need a ride? We've got somebody, you know, we can stop by in your area, carpooling people or whatever, getting them to the polls. Surprise, surprise. Well, I guess we shouldn't be surprised. We shouldn't be all that surprised. Cindy Sheehan update. President Bush, this from the afterdowningstreet.org blog by Patricia Wilson in Reuters. This is a Reuters story. President Bush got his first look at an anti-war vigil near his ranch on Friday as his motorcade took him by the protest site lined with small white crosses representing fallen American soldiers in Iraq. When Bush's black sport utility vehicle carried him past the site to a Republican fundraiser, the protest leader, Cindy Sheehan, whose son was one of the nearly 1,850 U.S. soldiers killed in Iraq, held up a sign that said, "Why do you make time for donors and not for me?" Why do you make time for donors and not for me? At the same time, you got the right wing going off saying, Cindy Sheehan, she's guilty of treason.
I think Mrs. Sheehan bears some responsibility for this, and also for the responsibility of other American families who have lost sons and daughters in Iraq who feel that this kind of behavior borders on treasonous.
Yeah, and O'Reilly and Michelle Malkin.
I can't imagine that Casey Sheehan would approve of such behavior,
well,
conduct.
Well, I have to
rhetoric.
Say that she obviously does.
And Cindy's rebuttal.
I didn't even know Casey knew Michelle Malkin, you know, and I'm Casey's mother. I know him better than anybody else in the world. And I know Casey is up there, and Casey's saying, you go, Mom. And he is just like saying, I can hear him going, George Bush did not know what he was going to unleash when he did this to me, you know. And I can't bring Casey back. And I wonder how often Michelle Malkin has sobbed on my son's grave. You know, did she come to his funeral? Did she sit up with him when he was sick, when he was a baby? You know, that to me, that is the most despicable thing. I can speak for my son. And I feel like it was a miracle that I got well yesterday. But, you know, I've been doing this for months, and I never get sick. I have the energy of 100 people, and I believe it's Casey and the rest of the people who have been killed so unjustly.
That Cindy Sheehan responding to Bill O'Reilly. We'll see you next week. Oh, no, wait a minute. We still have a few minutes left to go.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I love leaves in the wind, pictures of my friends, birds of the world, and squirrels.
There you go. Welcome back, my friends. 5 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman. Boy, I got my time cues wrong on that last segment. That's you can tell it's Friday. It's been a long week, a lot going on. And Cindy Sheehan is down there in Crawford, Texas, and the big call for action that Cindy Sheehan is putting out right now is, please come down to Crawford and stand with us. And if you go to meetwithcindy.com, it's right there. There's directions. There's MapQuest, how to get there. There's a link to afterdowningstreet.org, which is basically becoming the blog about what's going on with Cindy. The stories about Cindy. Hunger strikers for Cindy as a result of a request from Code Pink. People around the country are hunger striking for her. There's a rally in San Francisco tonight, this afternoon. Well, it starts actually in about 3 minutes here in Portland, Oregon. The Northwest chapter, local, 92 or chapter 92 or whatever, of the Veterans for Peace. VeteransForPeace.org, I believe, is their website, are meeting in downtown Portland, Oregon at 3rd and Madison, across from the federal building. And they've been out there every single day, you know, protesting in solidarity, holding up signs in solidarity with Cindy Sheehan. People all across America standing up in favor of and standing with Cindy Sheehan. At the same time that George W. Bush is trying to change the topic. He's trying to say, oh, this is about whether or not we should stay in Iraq. No, I'm sorry, it's about whether or not you lied us into Iraq. But here's Bush changing the topic.
You know, part of my duty as the president is to meet with those who've lost a loved one. And so, you know, listen, I sympathize with Mrs. Sheehan. She feels strongly about her position. She has every right in the world to say what she believes. This is America. She has a right to her position.
Isn't that sweet? Pat the little lady on the head. Yes, she has a right to her position. She feels strongly about her position. No, she feels strongly that her son died because you lied to us.
And I thought long and hard about her position. I've heard her position from others.
Now, her position is, President Bush, please tell us what the noble mission is that my son died for. And tell us, please, why, if it's so noble, your daughters have not enlisted.
Which is, get out of Iraq now.
No, that's not my position.
And, it would be a mistake for the security of this country and the ability to lay the foundations for peace in the long run if we were to do so.
Yeah, and that's extremely arguable, but it's not even the point. Of course, the Republican strategy, change the subject. George W. Bush. Thanks for being with us this week. Thanks to David for engineering our program today and Louise for producing it and to the folks in our chat room for showing up, our callers, our affiliates. We'll see you next week. Have a great weekend.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.